Joining me is director of the Libertarian Institute and author of Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. Scott, I want to open with Henry Kissinger's take on NATO. He says on page 90 of World Order, after four decades of Cold War, NATO had achieved the vision of the Cold War's end that its founders had proclaimed. The fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 led rapidly to unification of Germany, together with the collapse of the Soviet satellite orbit, the belt of states in Eastern Europe, with an imposed Soviet control system. In a testament to the vision of the Allied leaders who had designed the Atlantic Alliance, and to the subtle performance of those who oversaw the denouncement, the century's third contest over Europe ended peacefully. NATO is a great success. What's wrong with expanding NATO?
Well, I mean, to paraphrase, in fact, even Kissinger himself opposed NATO expansion, at least mildly, in the 1990s. And so did Brent Scowcroft and, you know, many of the wisest so-called graybeards of the American foreign policy establishment. Because, as Ambassador Jack Matlock put it, when you expand NATO, you're just drawing a new line of division. And so you're essentially changing who are the ins and who are the outs. But you're not changing the fact that there are ins and outs, unless you just somehow snap your fingers and create a world state where all militaries are subject to, you know, NATO oversight or whatever is the one world army. Then who's on the outside of it? Russia, China, India. There's not too many other powers of the earth, and India ain't much of one, but it's a populous nation anyway, potential power. But it's huge portions of the earth are not in NATO. Of course, Japan is sort of de facto. We don't call it NATO, but they're, you know, have a treaty of alliance with them and essentially with the rest of, at least a de facto alliance with the British Commonwealth, including Australia. I don't know if we have an official treaty of alliance with them or not. I guess I wouldn't be surprised if we did. But anyways, the point is that unless the Clinton government had immediately brought Yeltsin and the Russians into NATO, then it was by necessity directed against them. Otherwise, what is even the point of the damn thing? And, you know, honestly, man, I think that there's some truth in this, that they kind of thought at the time, well, this isn't really directed toward Russia. We just want to sell some airplanes and go to some cocktail parties, and we want to spread our security umbrella. Maybe it was more about, in fact, they talk about this, you know, it's about keeping the Czechs and the Slovaks from fighting. This is about keeping, you know, Pax Americana throughout Europe sort of the same way it is between Maine and California, right? That there's no state in our union powerful enough to start a war. Our federal government would never allow that to kind of break out, right? So same kind of thing here. And that's the thinking of it anyway, right? But the problem is beyond the frontier lies Russia. So at the end of the day, what do we got here? We have a military alliance that says if anybody attacks you, we'll go to war for you and protect you. And so it's not just a social club. Oh, I wanted to say about, you know, some of their talk about how, oh, this is harmless. This isn't directed toward Russia. We're just being friendly and all this. That Brent Scowcroft gave an interview where he talked about, and that's for people unfamiliar, that's George H.W. Bush's national security advisor, former four-star general, and, you know, was known as Bush Sr.'s alter ego and closest friend and co-author of his memoirs, okay, is who we're talking about here, George W. Bush's father's, you know, number one guy. And he said, you know, it's funny. I think a lot of the reason that they expanded NATO, it wasn't even about the military alliance or about Russia. You know what it was? They just wanted to integrate all of Europe, mostly like under the common market, under the European Union. There was a problem. I think he's implying here in brackets that France and Germany were worried about rapid immigration from the East because of this is, you know, all of the depressed economies of the communist states. You would have all these, you know, Czechs and Croats and whoever, all of them coming west into France and into Germany looking for work and that kind of thing. So they wanted to limit integration because of all the limits that would be raised on immigration if they did, right? So Brent Scowcroft says the Americans thought that NATO would be like a shortcut for getting Eastern Europe to join the EU. well, we'll just bring them into the military alliance first, and then that'll make it harder for France and Germany to tell them no to join the economic union. Again, you can see sort of like idiocy behind this, that what's the problem, you know? But Scowcroft's saying, well, I didn't think that was a very good idea. There's also a great quote that I have in my article that's up on antiwar.com today, by the way, from William Perry, who worked for Bill Clinton at the time, was the Secretary of Defense, and almost resigned over NATO expansion, the very first round of NATO expansion back then. And, I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought of what was the quote of Perry. Oh, it was saying, well, in the discussions, I would bring up Russia's point of view and say, look, guys, I think, you know, it's important that we take a look at how the Russians are going to perceive this. And he says, in fact, it's funny the way he says it. He kind of clarifies. He goes, I don't think it's that they didn't understand. It's that they would say, well, Russia's a third-rate power. What are they going to do? So the idea was, look, this really isn't directed against them. We're just making money and collecting Polish votes and Lockheed dollars and being Democrats, you know, here. If they do have a problem with it, well, tough. We're NATO, and they're just them. And in fact, I'm kicking myself because there was a better quote like that. So William Perry had like kind of a good paraphrase like that, where he's talking about what they said. But man, there was a quote that was even better. That was like for Madeleine Albright or something. That was more explicit. That then I went back and I couldn't find it. But it was more explicit. That was the paraphrase, or that was the quote was, yeah, but we're NATO. So what are they going to do about it? You know, something like that. I couldn't find it. It wasn't what are they going to do about it, but it was, that, those were the words, but that was the sentiment. But it was expressly invoking that, yeah, but we're NATO. So if they don't like NATO, yeah, but we're NATO. So, ha, right? So now, to be real clear here and specific for people, especially who, you know, aren't familiar with this at all, you know, I named a couple, but check it out, man. You had, in fact, let me pull it up here, dude, because I got this list. It's in my new article today, and I can find it here real quick with a control F. And let me just read this list of some of the, you know, so-called luminaries of the American foreign policy establishment that opposed NATO expansion. And this is just a few of them, okay? It's yeah. Brent Scowcroft, the currently serving Secretary of Defense William Perry under Bill Clinton, who again almost resigned over it. And man, I wish he would have. It would have been a much more, you know, important and notable thing. But anyway, George Kennan, who had coined the containment policy with his article on the sources of Soviet conduct in foreign affairs in 1946, written anonymously by X about how we must contain the Soviet Union, okay? He's considered the wisest, you know, like twice as wise as Kissinger, the one everyone is supposed to listen to, kind of a guy, George Kennan. And then his rival, Paul Nitze, who I called Robert on Fox News the other night, and so I looked stupid, but it's Paul Nitze. He's the author of NSC 68, the extremely important and infamous National Security Council memorandum mandating American world empire, which is, you know, a step or two beyond the containment recommended by Kennan. He was Kennan's more hawkish rival, Paul Nitze. Then you had Robert S. McNamara, self-confessed war criminal. And I urge everyone, just parentheses here, I urge everyone to watch The Fog of War, the documentary of Robert McNamara being interviewed by, oh, what's his name? It is absolutely something else. And he does admit, he confesses. The guy tricks him by making him look at himself in a mirror the whole time he's interviewing him. And he ends up admitting that, yeah, we were war criminals in World War II, in Korea. In World War II in Japan, in the Korean War, and in Vietnam. And we were behaving as war criminals, he says, about the war in Japan. And on and on, and all of his admissions about Vietnam. It's just incredible. But, you know, he's an extremely businesslike fellow, Robert McNamara. If you're not familiar with his character, the fact that he would have come out against NATO expansion, like that, you talk about a scratch the needle off the record, everybody shut the hell up and listen to what this man is saying type of a moment. And you can't beat that. Bob McNamara says this is a really bad idea to do this terrible, hawkish, violent, or potentially violent thing. Yeah, stop and listen, right? That's like Tony Soprano goes, Keith, slow down here. You go, oh, okay. You know what? Like, I'll let you be out ahead on when to swing, you know, Mr. Most Violent Guy in North Jersey. You know, I'll let you decide, not me. When the most violent man urges caution, wise men heed it, you know. Then the former CIA director Stansfield Turner and Robert Gates, believe it or not, famously Secretary of Defense under W. Bush and Barack Obama. Before that, he had been the deputy director of the CIA under Reagan and then the director under Bush Sr. And he'd come out in the 90s against it. And later he slammed W. Bush for bringing in the Baltics and promising to bring in Ukraine and NATO. Sounds just like me. Except guess what? He was the Secretary of Defense at the time in the year 2008 at the Bucharest meeting and all this. He didn't resign over that. You know, he stayed in power. He didn't resign until 2011. And after he got out in 2011, he slammed Obama for the war in Libya. That he was the Secretary of Defense who implemented it, you know, and he didn't resign over that war. He implemented the war and then resigned a few months into it and didn't say, I'm resigning over this war in any way whatsoever. So Robert Gates is just a horrible, horrible man. I wanted to make that clear. But even the horrible, horrible, blood-soaked Robert Gates, overseer of the failed Iraq war surge and the war in Libya, said we shouldn't do it. Ambassador Jack Matlock, who I mentioned before, was the second to last ambassador to the USSR under H.W. Bush. And then I'm not sure you're probably familiar, Keith, with Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is the important neoconservative senator from I'm going to say Massachusetts, something like that. But he was a former leftist turned right winger. And I'm not sure if he was exactly like, I think he was an official neocon with the group. I'm not positive about that. I'm pretty sure. But very interesting guy. I remember watching him on TV with my dad when I was a kid a lot. You know, very important politician, real thinking guy. John Warner and Sam Nunn and Bill Bradley were both known as, I'm not sure as sure about Warner, but Nunn and Bradley were known as two of the greatest Russia experts in the Senate who really knew what they were doing. It was Nunn and Lugar. You might remember Dick Lugar, who was the foreign policy expert, Republican, less worse than some, I guess. But it was the Nunn-Lugar Act that established the mechanism for setting up the Americans to help disarm the Soviet Union of many of their nukes and implementation of the treaties and all that. If I have that right. Anyway, Sam Nunn, I think that's right. Sam Nunn, real expert, and Bill Bradley, you might remember, tried to primary Al Gore in 2000 to be the Democrat nominee, and he was obviously the much more decent guy in that race and knew a thing or two about Russia. I think he'd been an exchange student over there, something like that, so he was a real expert on Russia. And then even Richard Pipes, who was, and Edward Luttwak, both of whom were, I think Pipes was just a right-winger, Luttwak was a neocon, but both of them severely anti-Soviet intellectuals, also had signed on. And then what you can do is you look up Susan Eisenhower, who was Dwight David Eisenhower's granddaughter. And she organized a group of 50 of these luminaries, as they call themselves, and including, you know, a dozen or more generals and admirals and all different ambassadors and State Department employees and Foreign Service veterans of every description, experts of every description, Council on Foreign Relations men from the very top of the heap saying, do not do this. You're going to make an enemy out of Russia right after we won a bloodless, peaceful victory and the total disillusion of the Soviet Union and world communism. And now you're going to blow it. And I got to tell you, I mean, I have the quote here. They says, in their open letter, the open letter of 50 people, Keith, they say, this is a policy error of historic proportions, right? In other words, they'd use the F word if Foreign Service officers used the F word other than Victoria Nuland. But this is the strongest language that they can think of to use, that this is not smart policy at all. This is horrible. But we know from the history of it, they did it for the Lockheed dollars and the Polish votes. They didn't do it because of Poland. They didn't do it because of Russia. They didn't do it because of Hungary and the Czech Republic. They did it because Democrats like votes and money. And that was why. And the Senate just went along with it because what do they care? They like votes and money too. And there was just no thinking behind it. That's the famous rant of George Kennan in 1998 to Thomas L. Friedman in the New York Times. He attacks the Senate for confirming the thing, or being, I guess, about to confirm it at that time. And he's saying, these stupid senators, they don't even know the first thing about foreign affairs. They don't even have any interest in this at all. They're just going along with this stupid thing. You know, their job is advice and consent. Their job is to make sure that this is the right thing before you do something so drastic, expand the military lines. This is George Kennan. He's saying our founding fathers are rolling over in their graves over this. Again, you can't get in any stronger language than these warnings. And Keith, it ain't like they said this 30 years ago, 25 years ago, and then forgot about it. They were warning all along. I mean, I think after, you know, Bush brought so many more countries in, probably some of the criticism got muted that just, oh, it's such a fait accompli now. There's nothing left to oppose. Like, it's just done. They already brought in the Baltics, for Christ's sake, you know. Then the question just came down to, are we going to bring in Ukraine and Georgia, too, as Bush had promised in 2008. But, you know, man, I'm not sure about your experience growing up, but I'll tell you, like, my fourth and fifth grade, I had a really good fifth grade history/social studies teacher. He taught us all this stuff. And the bottom line essentially was, the adults have this democracy. And in the democracy, they debate everything and they decide what to do, or at least they pick the very best of them to decide what they do. And they make the best choices they can at the time. And essentially, who the hell are you, little kid, to question that this is how history happened? The American people decided they wanted a new deal. The American people decided they wanted to go to Vietnam, and then they decided they wanted to come home from the thing. You know, the American people nuked Japan. In fact, that was one where he brought it up. They're like, actually, this is questionable. A lot of people don't agree about this. And I remember me and I think probably the whole class thought, well, what do you mean people question it? The president wouldn't have done it if he didn't have to do it. That's what it means to have a democracy. If it wasn't the right thing, it wouldn't be happening. And so anyway, the point I'm getting to here is just the inevitability of the course of history as we are supposed to perceive it, and how I reject that. I think it's just not right. I think you could have had, you know, William Perry could have said to Bill Clinton, listen, damn it, Strobe Talbot doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. You can't do this. But instead he didn't. Instead he said, well, Mr. President, I think probably it would be unwise, but it's up to you, of course. And he didn't fight about it hard enough. And that was it. It was in that moment that William Perry didn't raise his voice that the history of the world took a turn that it shouldn't have taken. It didn't have to be this way whatsoever. And the fact that Henry Kissinger and Brent Scowcroft said not to do it, never mind our heroes, Doug Bondo and Ted Carpenter and Ron Paul and all of the real greats. But I'm talking about the bad guys who knew better. I'm talking about the architects of the world empire who said, this is pushing it too far. We should not be doing this. And people, you know, on Twitter, there was a great thread the other day. A guy went and found some Kissinger quotes where he's talking about, oh, my God, you got to understand the centrality, the importance of Ukraine to Russia. You know, also, about, hey, a country could choose their own alliances. Yeah, really? You mean Russia could choose to make an alliance with Mexico? Yeah, no, they could not. We would go to war. And you go, oh, Mexico's sovereign. They can decide to make a military alliance with one of America's military rivals on the planet. And I'll tell you, nuh-uh, not without getting bombed, they can't. And, you know, if you put your shoe on the other foot here, if you took the extent of America's, aggressive expansion into Russia's military sphere of influence here, right on their front porch like that, if they were to pull this kind of stunt in Mexico or Canada, America would have gone to nuclear war a long time ago. I mean, invade Canada and put, you know, overthrow and do a regime change and force Russia's friends out, that'd be one thing. But I think the Americans would just nuke Moscow. And you think about how absolutely panicked and freaked they were over the Russiagate hoax that never even happened. I mean, imagine, seriously, it shouldn't be too hard to imagine. Imagine for real, the Russians were integrating Latin America into their military alliance. They'd already integrated Western Europe. Now they're moving on Latin America and Canada. And they use Nazi skinheads to overthrow the government in Ottawa. They start threatening to kick us out of our military bases in Alaska. And they declare a war against the people of British Columbia who refuse to accept the new coup junta that they've installed there. What would America do? We'd be rolling armor into Canada to absolutely crush the Quislings. They would be dead, dead, dead. And it's virtually certain we'd go to nuclear war before it ever even got anywhere near that far. The American, you know, political and foreign policy and military establishment would go absolutely nervous breakdown, full H-bomb deployment mode, I think, in a situation like that. Now, here's Vladimir Putin going, man, our American partners sure are trying our patience a lot. And so, you know, I'm not justifying what he did, but I'm just saying it's less than what America would have done in the same circumstance. You know, they would have gone. In fact, he just like put the same people in his position. They would have invaded probably not just Ukraine, but the Baltics and Poland and Slovakia, just to make themselves perfectly clear. Or they would have bombed Japan or China or Brazil or some completely unrelated country, right? Just to make an example out of them.
Well, and another contribution of Susan Eisenhower was documenting and popularizing the meeting between James Baker and Mikhail Gorbachev, which was the promise, look, if we get Germany reunified and Germany joins NATO, then there won't be any NATO expansion eastward. There won't need to be, because there won't be a Soviet empire that we are in opposition to. And right. Still, in opposition to the agreement, they still expanded. So, in this, it's still important to remember Russiagate, because this changes it from an issue over the Donbass far away from us to, well, yeah, Putin's screwing with our elections too. Here is the best argument for Russiagate in November of 2021 by David Frum, titled, "It Wasn't a Hoax." He writes this in The Atlantic. He said, here are the main points of the article. It remains fact that Russian hackers and spies helped his, Trump's, campaign. It remains fact that the Trump campaign welcomed the help. It remains fact that Trump's campaign chairman sought to share proprietary campaign information with a person.
Wait, slow down. I'm not going to be able to remember all this. I mean, go through them one at a time here. We'll do them.
It remains fact Russian hackers and spies helped his campaign. True or false?
Well, yeah, just completely false. And of course, you see how vague he's being there. He can't say. We know for a fact they did the DNC hack. We know for a fact they did the Podesta hack. We know for a fact that they transferred this data to WikiLeaks. We don't know that whatsoever. And the Mueller report admitted we have no chain of custody to WikiLeaks whatsoever here. We have no idea who gave this stuff to Julian Assange, admits Robert Mueller. So what is it that he's referring to? You can, I guess, try to dump something there's down or make something new up to fit in there. But no, there's no hacking.
There's not even a link,
because there was two parts, wasn't it?
I'll go back. But there's not even a link to click on in the article, and he does that in his Atlantic article. So he chose not to put a link in there. The second, it remains fact that the Trump campaign welcomed the help.
Well, no, I mean, even that was obviously a Trump joke that he's referring to at the rally. And this just goes to show how absolutely thin and stupid and desperate these idiots are. David Frum, the idiotist among them all, that this is all they got, is that at a rally, Trump was making a point about the fact that Hillary Clinton was guilty of the felony of obstruction of justice because she had destroyed hard drives with 30,000, at least 30,000 emails on them that she lied, obviously perjured herself and her campaign and the rest of them claimed were personal private emails. And then she said, yeah, you know, it's like me emailing back and forth with Bill about I got yoga tonight. And then that's funny because we got Bill on camera saying he sent an email twice from somebody else's account in his entire life. He doesn't have email. He doesn't do email. He never did. And so, you know, we know she's a liar right friggin' there. And of course, 30,000 emails. Yeah, right. And it was her and her own people who deleted them all and destroyed them all forever. So then Trump did a speech. And he goes, they keep saying that the Russians are hacking and giving the stuff to WikiLeaks and all this stuff. Well, I don't know about that, which there's no reason whatsoever to believe that, never mind evidence of it. There's not even an indication that that's true other than lies, other than a total hoax perpetrated by these people. But anyway, Trump says, By the way, Russia, if you're listening, there's still 30,000 missing emails, which is a joke I've made a bunch of times, too. I'll make it right now. Russia or China or any other foreign enemy, if you could please find those 30,000 missing Hillary Clinton emails, I bet you they're not about yoga practice. I would like very much to see them. I think we all know what they are. It's her communicating with foreign governments about how much they have to pay her and her foundation to get a foreign policy that they want out of Barack Obama. That's what's in those emails, and we all know it. Not like she'd go to prison anyway. It's not like there's a rule of law. So come on, Russia, leak them damn emails. Anyway, that's all. That's all Trump was doing, was making fun of Hillary Clinton for being a liar and a criminal. And even then, even saying, by the way, like whoever's got those emails, sure, Russia, leak them. There ain't nothing wrong with that anyway. Even if you take that purely at face value, what right does she have to delete 30,000 of the people's emails, Keith? None whatsoever. And I've long been a fan of the principle. I don't know who coined this or what, but it's something that Greenwald has talked about for years and certainly precedes him, which is that it doesn't matter what the source is. Like, for example, and this is like this can be tricky in journalism, right? Like, you know, the CIA is kind of using you to push this story out, but you do think it's true and they do have good, you know what I mean? This kind of thing. So you go ahead and report it, even if, or for example, if it's a crime to leak Donald Trump's taxes, this is one a liberal like better. If it's a crime to steal and leak Donald Trump's taxes to the New York Times, if you're the New York Times, you go, I don't care who did this to him, if it was his niece or if it was a jaded business partner or if it was the CIA, whoever leaked these tax returns to us, we're going to report it, which is fair. Same thing if it was the Russians who leaked Donald Trump's tax returns to the New York Times. And it might be good if they included in the article that we have reason to believe it was the Russians who gave us this, which is kind of weird. But anyway, here you go. It's just no different than, look, for example, at the Victoria Nuland phone call where they're plotting the coup in Ukraine in 2014. And that thing's on YouTube to this moment right now. Original version still up there that they posted. I'm almost sure it's the same channel and everything.
And she was assistant secretary to the state. What was her title again?
I believe it was Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, or no, for European Affairs, which is sort of like an ambassador to the EU kind of a position.
Mm-hmm. Now,
and there's every reason to believe that that phone call was intercepted and recorded and leaked by Russia. So what? Good.
Yeah, really.
Thank God. And you know what, Russia, if you're listening, there's 30,000 more Victoria Nuland phone calls that we would all like to hear. So by all means, publish them all. We hate the Kagans. They're the worst thing about America. Now, I wouldn't want the Russian government to actually do something to a Kagan. But to intercept and leak their phone calls, I certainly don't object. And now think about it like this. Never mind calling for them to leak more Kagan calls. But how about just the one we got that they posted? What should we do, Keith? Not talk about the F the EU phone call and all the important stuff in there? Because geez, the origin comes from this foreign government that wanted us to hear it. You know what? We wanted to hear it for the same reason that foreign government wanted us to hear it. This is Americans plotting a coup d'etat in Ukraine. And that might be a coup that's against Russia's interests, but that doesn't mean it's for America's interests. That just means it's for Kagan's interests. And that's different. And so, you know, we absolutely have the right to know and should want to know and have the right to keep passing that around. So, anyway, the whole thing was completely overblown. But here's the real reality, right, is, and see, you and I probably maybe are guilty of the same thing here where we're so caught up in arguing against this ridiculous panic attack by these people and how stupid it all is, right? We kind of maybe sometimes fail to put ourselves in their shoes about just how hysterical and terrified these people were. That, as you just said, this isn't just a debate about what's going on in the Donbass. This is Vladimir Putin overthrew the United States government. And the guy that they installed, it's not the same old Donald Trump you've known your whole life. No, it's Donald Trump, Hitler, the leader of the Ku Klux Klan and leader of the right-wing fascist revolution to take over America and kick all the black people out or whatever it is that you're supposed to believe if you're like a liberal Democrat woman in the Trump years. So this guy, first of all, he's Hitler. And second of all, Vladimir Putin installed him in power as a compromised Manchurian candidate is something that in all the years of the Cold War, no one ever thought that the Russians really took over America, right? Now they've done it, you know? So imagine for a minute, if you really believed that for 3 years, obviously, first of all, how stupid you'd have had to have been, but also just like how emotional you would be about that. You know what I mean? Like, oh my God, that Vladimir Putin. So this is a guy who he's done something very terrible to you before already. This is not in the Donbass, thousands of miles from here. This is your life, you know? Meanwhile, none of that was true. None of it was true. But man, did they believe it. And so, yes, I think that that has absolutely just completely poisoned the mindset of the entire left half of the American political spectrum. And for that matter, the entire national security state and all the damn Lincoln Republicans and neocons and rhinos and never Trumpers and whatever on kind of the center right, too. That they'll never let that go. It doesn't matter that Robert Mueller turned up a no bill. Because they had jack squat against anyone on this collusion with Russia thing. They just forgot all that and went right back to, you know, I can't remember who tweeted it. Someone sent me a thing or had a guy embedded in their article saying, you see, there's a direct through line from Russia's installation of Donald Trump back then to what's going on in the Donbass now. And it's just, whatever, dude. Yeah, because you're a Democrat and you think that. You know what I mean? They're stuck this way. They're like Republicans who believed in W. Bush and his wars. Like, how do you get them to climb down from that? It took not just Ron Paul. It took Donald Trump in 13 years later, Keith, to say, screw W. Bush and his stupid wars. Everybody hates that. And then they were like, okay. You know what I mean? But like, that was what it took. It took 13 years. So they're never, for intents and purposes, they're never climbing out of this psychosis. They are stuck like this. And they got us, you know, nose to nose with a thermonuclear weapons state, buddy boy.
Well, and also it's almost as though the press and the politicians were able to make what might be a nothing burger out of into something huge. For example, if you go to Hillary Clinton's foundation's website, you can look in the large donor section, and between $10 million and $25 million donations is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Kingdom of Norway. So we explicitly have collusion between these groups. We have Barack Obama going to the other country of the UK to say, don't vote for Brexit. He comes out in support of Emmanuel Macron. That's interference. He supports Justin Trudeau. That's foreign interference. It's like these things, when they're done explicitly, it's okay. But when they're not done explicitly, they're evil. It's like killing a person's bad, but mass murder in war, well, that's actually a good thing. That's spreading democracy. So it's all in this spin. I want to go through a couple more of these. It remains fact that Trump's campaign chairman sought to share proprietary campaign information with a person whom the Senate report identified as a Russian intelligence officer.
Right. Now, right there. The Senate report, the reason he has to resort to the Senate report is because he doesn't have another scrap of paper anywhere in the world that can substantiate this. Senate report doesn't substantiate it either. The Senate report, I think maybe there's a Treasury report that makes the same claim, again, completely unsourced. So I think the Senate report is just citing the Treasury report. And then, but it's total BS. There's no other reason in the world to believe this. And Robert Mueller never claimed this. That's why he's not citing the Robert Mueller report. It's a total hoax. And we already know what was going on there, which was Manafort was showing polling results to this guy who was not connected to Russian intelligence. He worked for John McCain at the International Republican Institute and was an informant for the U.S. State Department. He wasn't an agent of the Kremlin. And the reason Manafort was showing him polling results is because he was saying, check it out, my guy can win this race. Everybody thinks that Hillary's going to win, but I don't think so. I think he can win. And that means I'm a very valuable guy for you to know because I'm connected to the guy who's going to win the presidency. So remember how I owe you all that money? Like, we're going to be able to work that out now. And that was what was going on there, was Manafort's own corruption and trying to essentially, like, make things right with people he was in business with. That did not have a single damned thing to do whatsoever with a Russian government intervention in our election in any way at all. any more than when I tied my shoelaces this morning. It has nothing to do with it. It's, again, that's why he's got to do a little bullet point. He can't explain any of this because it's just a bunch of crap. So he has to go, well, the Senate report said. Yeah, well, let's look at what the Senate report said. The Senate report goes, oh, yeah, well, this guy is intelligence, maybe, we think, somebody said. Yeah, great. He's not. We know he's not. He's John McCain's man, not Vladimir Putin's man. For the love of God, man, seriously.
That's worse.
You know, that's, yeah, of course it's worse, but it makes him a loyal American patriot in the very worst way, not an agent of a foreign power that somehow, man, remember the point that you were supposed to believe from all of that was that this is what shows that Manafort's job is controlling Trump for Putin. That that's who this guy is. And this is the go-between. Why do you think he's showing them the polling results? It's so they can target the Facebook ads to change the votes. No, there's no evidence of that whatsoever. It's just made up. It's just made up connection, made up cause and effect. There's no reason to believe that whatsoever. We already know from the testimony of all the participants. And Aaron Maté interviewed the guy, and I forget, one or two other people interviewed the guy. And even where they say, you know, Kalimnik, that, oh, he had a Russian diplomatic passport that proves that he was a spy and came into the country on this day. Well, he shows Aaron Maté his plain old regular passport that's stamped with that date on it. So, lie disproved, right? It's not, I mean, other than like, you got to make up a whole new conspiracy theory that the FSB faked the whole passport and the American stamp and backdated it and all this crap. In other words, you're just lying. Making up garbage fit for the Atlantic, right? But otherwise, we know that this accusation is not true. Okay, next one.
Yeah, and I love Aaron Maté's interview with Luke Harding, the guy who said Roger Stone met with Julian Assange. He just knocks that one out of the park. It basically ends here. It remains fact that Trump hoped to score a huge payday in Russia. Even as he ran for president, it remains fact that Trump and those around him lied and lied and lied again about their connections to Russia. Any final comments on Russiagate?
Yeah, he wanted to build a hotel in Russia, and he asked his lawyer to organize it and try to do it. And all his lawyer did, as they admitted in the Mueller report, you can read it yourself, is he said he couldn't figure out how to contact anybody at the Kremlin anywhere. So what he did was he sent an email through the email form on their website that anyone in the world could just send an email to the office on their form. And the email was like, hey, I've been trying to get all of you guys because we want to look into, you know, building a hotel there. And then I think he had a hard time getting a hold of them. And the way Mueller tells it, when they finally did get back in touch with him, they were like, yeah, no, we can't help you. And then that was it. There wasn't anyone involved on any level that connected to Vladimir Putin or to powerful people who were doing this, who like were the go-between where Vladimir Putin and his regime were authorizing this hotel to go through or any of these things. That was all just the implication that maybe we'll find out that that was what happened, but that's not what we found out was what happened because that's not what happened. There was just nothing to it at all. So what does Frum mean by that? Oh, he hoped to profit from Russia. So what? He hoped to build a hotel in Moscow. Well, the guy builds hotels places. Where's the quid pro quo? There's not one. And meanwhile, the whole idea here is behind his crap is that Trump is a disloyal American traitor. But that's just not true. And he said it himself, and you know that this is right, dude. Yeah, I went and met with Henry Kissinger, and he told me that I was real, real smart because he agrees with me that we ought to be friends with Russia to balance against China. This is Henry Kissinger, who split China off from Russia 50 years ago, is now saying, now that China's the more powerful one, we should be leaning toward Russia. Problem is, the American foreign policy establishment is not on the same page with Henry Kissinger anymore. Well, that might be all fine and good or horrible, but what Henry Kissinger ain't is the guy who controls Donald Trump for Vladimir Putin. And not one of these scumbags like David Frum would have the courage to make a claim like that, would they? But meanwhile, I mean, are you skeptical of that? When Donald Trump goes, yeah, I met Henry Kissinger, and he told me, wow, Donald Trump, You're the smartest, tallest, wealthiest guy I've ever met. And you sure are smart about Russia. I'm like, dude, I know that's a true story. At least the last part. You know, the last part about Kissinger told me, pat on the head, your Russia instincts are good. It's China that we should worry about. We should be befriending Putin instead. We know this is what Kissinger thinks. And there is a segment of the foreign policy establishment who had been thinking like that, at least, you know, in those times. And Kissinger has defended Putin essentially numerous times. I remember seeing Kissinger saying, now, listen, all this talk about Putin is Hitler and a dictator. I mean, he's a pretty strong man, but let's get real. He served presidential terms. He changes the Constitution to stay in power. Yeah, but he has not declared himself the czar. He's not changed the form of government. He evidently means to leave something like a Republican form of government behind him when he eventually does leave power, with regular elections and a presidency, not an emperorship and this kind of thing. And so, like, quit calling my man Hitler. He's a lot more like Hindenburg. And, you know, so, you know, as Lou Rockwell once wrote, it's a heck of a note to have to root for the Rockefellers. But it's from time to time they have their strong points compared to some of these, you know, crazier loons who've inherited their world empire.
So we've gone over NATO expansion. We've gone over whether Putin has more or less staged a coup in America. We can dismiss those. I want to talk about Putin's February 24th address. He mentions three things. This brings me to the situation in Donbass. We can see that the forces that staged the coup in Ukraine in 2014 have seized power, are keeping it with the help of ornamental election procedures, and have abandoned the path to a peaceful conflict settlement. For eight endless years, we have been doing everything possible to settle the situation by peaceful political means. Everything was in vain. As I said in my previous address, you cannot look without compassion at what is happening there in the Donbass. It became impossible to tolerate it. We had to stop that atrocity, that genocide of millions of people who live there and who pin their hopes on Russia, on all of us. He then goes on to mention, moreover, they, government of Ukraine, went as far as to aspire to acquire nuclear weapons. We will not let this happen. So, yeah. Coup in 2014, mass murder against the people, Russian separatists in the Donbass region, and acquiring nukes. What do we need to know about those?
All right. Well, so first of all, he's absolutely right about the coup in 2014. And he's absolutely right that, oh, yeah, sure, they hold elections since then, but they're ornamental because all the people who were on the outs who got their guy overthrown, they don't get to vote. And you could say that's partly their fault because they tried to just secede from the Union there in the far eastern part of the country there in the Donbass. But why should they, you know, honor a process that's run by a coup junta? You overthrow a democratically elected leader and then you hold a new election and that's supposed to be, you know, free and fair. And then if I lose, I'm supposed to just suck it up, even though you just overthrew my guy before his term was up, you know, this kind of thing. So you could see why they reacted in that way. And you know, who knows about the rest of the corruption ballot box stuffing? It's one of the most corrupt countries in the world, other than America, Iraq, and Afghanistan, you know. And it's true. We've talked about Crimea before as the direct aftermath of the coup of 2014. But then this war broke out in the Donbass where they refused to recognize the new government. And the government declared a war on terrorism and invaded. And it was a horrible war. You know, more than 10,000 people died in the initial war. And then I don't know exactly how many people have died. They say it's 14 to 15,000 people dead total now. I don't know how many of those people have died over the last 8 years, but there's been low-level fighting essentially all along. So he's right that there was this horrible coup, that so-called democracy in Ukraine since the coup is null and void, just public relations, but nothing that you could really, you know, say is legitimate at all as far as that goes. And the ongoing violence of the war in the Donbass is a real concern. But then here's where we get to the BS, which I think he's just concern trolling the Americans, where he's just making fun of the Americans. He's invoking Bill Clinton's excuse for intervention in Kosovo and Barack Obama's excuse for intervention in Libya. And he's invoking George W. Bush's excuse for invading Iraq. And apparently, you can start an aggressive war without a vote of your Congress or a UN resolution from the Security Council, as long as you make up an excuse first. And so in this case, millions of people in the Donbass are under threat. Come on. Again, casualties are 15,000. That's horrible. But that's like Barack Obama claiming that Gaddafi, well, it's like Bill Clinton claiming that the Serbs had just murdered 100,000 when they just hadn't. Just hadn't. And like Obama claiming that Gaddafi's about to murder 700,000 if we don't get there in time, which was also a completely ridiculous hoax. I mean, of all the ridiculous hoaxes, for God's sake, man. So essentially, he's got his own little hoax here. Like, oh, yeah, nah, millions of people are in danger. Like, yeah, okay, not so much, really. But so that's his excuse there. And then the weapons of mass destruction. Now, it's true that at the Munich Security Conference, Zelensky, and I don't know if they put him up to this or what, man, I think they might have. Zelensky said, hey, look, you know what? Since everybody's in, violating the old agreement from 91 now, I think maybe we'll go ahead and work on obtaining nuclear weapons. Now, Putin knows it. No, America and its allies are not going to hand Ukraine's government a nuke. You know, I mean, they violate their treaties a lot, but they're not known to pass out nuclear bombs. I mean, the Israelis gave them to South Africa, but they're not members of the NPT. America's never given nukes to any. Well, I guess they sort of gave them to Israel. They let Israel, you know, LBJ let Israel steal them, or steal the material for nukes. But anyway, nobody's going to hand Ukraine nukes. If they were going to make them, they'd need years and all kinds of expertise that, like, maybe they could dig back up from the old days, but maybe not. Certainly you cannot just snap your fingers and make an atom bomb. They would need a massive project to do so. So for Putin to say, you hear that? He said atom bomb. Come on, everybody, we're going. Like, I could see that being the last straw. And I have to tell you too that I think I answered that question, so I'll take this tangent then. That more and more, Keith, I think they wanted this to happen. And I think this is why I screwed up the call on whether Putin was going to invade or not. Was I really had thought, and I explained my reasoning at the time, I thought Biden was backing down. I thought Biden was giving, hopefully, you know, good enough assurances that we're not going to bring Ukraine into NATO, and we're not going to station mid-range nuclear missiles in Ukraine, and we'll let you inspect our missile launchers in Romania and Poland and verify that we're not installing Tomahawks there, which I don't believe they have any intention of installing Tomahawks there, but that's, you know, Putin's obviously stated concern. And they did tear up the INF treaty, Donald Trump and his government did. So, you know, it's a concern. But so I thought that under the guidance of William Burns, the CIA chief, who I know is the former ambassador to Russia and knows Sergei Lavrov and wrote the Nyet Means Nyet memo of 2008 to Condoleezza Rice, warning that we better not bring Ukraine or Georgia in, that he would essentially guide Biden on the proper decision and, you know, the proper way to essentially appease Putin's legitimate security concerns, not ridiculous ones, but the legitimate ones that were, you know, a cause for war. And I guess, Keith, you know, thinking back on the words out of my mouth, it sounds kind of ignorant that I was saying, well, you know, Biden has promised we're definitely not bringing Ukraine into NATO anytime in the next 10 years. And that's believable, right? I mean, they got this crazy ongoing border dispute. You got France and Germany. Pardon me. You have France and Germany who just have no interest in bringing Ukraine into NATO, right? So why not just put it in writing? And why allow or speculation prod Zelensky into bringing up atom bombs at the Munich Security Conference? Unless they were trying to provoke the attack to happen. And I kind of am embarrassed that after all we've been through, I was still kind of looking at this sort of naively, that the Americans, by warning and warning and warning against the invasion, that they really were trying to dissuade it. And that with William Burns, the CIA director, who I'm not saying he's the greatest guy in the world, but he's a lifelong diplomat, not a lifelong throat-cutting maniac. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. I thought, I guess I didn't allow myself to be cynical or allow myself. I didn't even come up really in my head that like, oh man, they are deliberately trying to provoke this thing to happen. And frankly, I had missed that thing about maybe we'll make atom bombs at the Munich Security Conference. Or if that had happened, I had just thought, ah, oh, geez, but I didn't really make a big deal about it in my head that, boy, he's serving up a casus belli for Vladimir Putin right there. For all of Putin's wiles, I think he may have fallen for this. And here's why I really think this. And knowing you, I think you probably did force yourself to sit through that 2-hour-long speech that I gave last Saturday, Keith. I don't know if you did or not, but I have the written version posted at antiwar.com today, and I've added a bunch to it. That I'm going to give a speech again in Kentucky this weekend, and I've added a bunch onto it. And what it is it's making the case, essentially quoting a bunch of different officials, military and civilian, and, you know, David Ignatius at the Post and some of these people talking about what they really want here is to try to replicate Afghanistan in Ukraine. We'll give them their own Vietnam again. We'll give them their own Afghanistan again. Never mind what just happened to us in Afghanistan. And Keith, you know, for you and your audience, anybody who hasn't seen this, you have to go and look up this clip of Hillary Clinton on MSNBC. And God forgive me for saying that to you. I know, because I don't want to listen to that woman's voice either. And frankly, I put off playing the damn thing for 12 hours and went and slept on it first because I just don't want to hit play on anything where I can see that face of hers. Man, I just know what she sounds like and I don't want to hear it, you know. But then I read some of the quotes and they had ellipses in them and stuff. And I was like, nah, man, this isn't good enough. I got to sit and listen to this and transcribe this out myself. And sorry, I'm rambling on about this, but that's sort of the point here is that she's Hillary Clinton. So unlike when any of the rest of us are on TV and you have this short amount of time to say what you want, she's like Duchess Hillary. You have to let her ramble. So nobody interrupts her. And it's just, as they say, just verbal diarrhea. She's just going, just blabbing, and she just keeps talking. And you think Bill is probably off screen going, oh, God, shut up. Like, it's too much. It's just too much. And she is just elaborating on how, yeah, man, we could arm the insurrection. We could do just like we did in Afghanistan in the 80s. And, man, you know, the Russians, they were defeated. And, you know, yeah, there were some unintended consequences there. But anyway, what we could do in Ukraine, we could do the same thing and we'll put in all these weapons and all these things. And it's like, wow, did I just hear you refer to our 30-year war on terrorism, starting with the first World Trade Center bombing when her and her husband had been in power for a month and a week in 1993, February 26, 1993. From that day to right now, 2 million dead, 7,000 American troops, 30,000 dead from suicide, tens and tens, 50, 75,000 of them horribly maimed, 37 million people displaced from Nigeria to the Philippines, an absolute, you know, turmoil and revolution and radicalism and religion and politics and just everywhere, again, all across West, North, and East Africa, into all of Arabia, Mesopotamia, the Levant, and to Central Asia. All of this, all of it gets a chuckle and a shrug and a unintended consequences, not even worth mentioning, Keith. The entire terrorist war against the American people, including 3,000 of her constituents slaughtered when she's a senator on September 11th, And 2 million people killed since then, $10 trillion blown, the 21st century and the new millennium just completely botched from the get-go on her vote, too, with her riding shotgun with W. Bush and Barack Obama this whole time, and her husband before that. And it's worth some unintended consequences, quote, unquote. And that's it. Means nothing to her, nothing. Now on to the next one. And what are we talking about? We're going to recruit up, we're going to build up a stay-behind army of neo-fascists to be our Mujahideen in Ukraine. These guys are going to make the moderate rebels in Syria, these suicide bomber fucking maniacs that Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus and Barack Obama supported for years there. We already have from earlier in the war from The Intercept reporting of jihadists from Syria going to Ukraine to fight with the Nazis against the Russians in the Donbass. This has been going on. And now this is the stay behind army that we're building, not to fight the USSR, Keith, but to fight Vladimir Putin. We're going to build up a bunch of the grandsons of the Galatian SS to be a stay behind force. And I got, you can look at my article today. It's down toward the bottom there. I got quote after quote after quote after quote, all these articles coming out, all these people just blabbing like Hillary Clinton, saying way too much about, yeah, man, this is what we want, is to bog them down and bleed them and weaken Russia. That Putin thinks he's so smart, he's bitten off more than he could chew now. We're going to arm up this insurgency against, we're going to flow in all these weapons. There's a great new article at the Libertarian Institute right now by Will Porter about the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons flowing into Ukraine right now after the invasion to begin to fight this insurgency. You know what they're not saying, Keith? They're not saying, oh my God, we have got to have some kind of summit and hammer this thing out. We have got to get Sergey Lavrov and Tony Blinken on the same page here, man. We can, humanity can't afford this. We just can't do this. They're not saying that, Keith. They're not saying that. They're saying we're going to bog them down. We're going to bleed them dry. We're going to do like we did to them in Afghanistan and in Syria. We learned so much from Afghanistan and Syria. Really? You did? In Afghanistan, the Taliban's in power. In Syria, 500,000 people are dead. The whole country is reduced to North Korean levels of poverty. And Bashar al-Assad is still sitting in the chair and still helping Iran arm Hezbollah, just like when you guys started this big stupid project 20 years ago. I mean, man, they're crazy. These people are crazy. I posted this thing on my Twitter today by a former CIA officer writing in Foreign Affairs, talking about how we got to do this. Oh, it's so much fun to arm insurgencies. You know what, Keith? We're not very good at defeating insurgencies, but we sure can promote them. I mean, they're talking about murder. They're talking about suicide bombing and torture, war crimes, killing children. They're talking about Jabhat al-Nusra. They're talking about terrorists who would be their justification to intervene in any other circumstance. You know, they want to launch a domestic war on terrorism here where they pretend that the entire right half of America are in fact the far right 0.1%. You know, hardcore Nazi white supremacists, which is just not true. And then what are they doing? They're building up a giant Nazi training ground for Nazis. And this has been going on again. The war broke out in 14. You know, we're having this conversation 8 years into this conflict. We've had 8 years of neo-Nazis from around the world go to Ukraine to fight with these guys. As I learned recently in an interview, one of them, an American who had gone to fight with the Nazis in Ukraine, came home and was arrested at Charlottesville. Was one of the guys involved in the violence of Charlottesville. And, you know, who knows how many more. You know, the FBI admitted they weren't even keeping track of all the Americans who were traveling to Syria to go fight in the suicide bomber brigades and which ones were then going to come home. So who knows if they're tracking the Nazis who go over there. But, hey, it's all in the game, right? That's why they call it a self-licking ice cream cone, dude. No problem, Keith. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to support all these Nazis, and when they come home and start killing people here, well, that'll give us a bunch of stuff to do, too. We'll never have to get real jobs. It'll be great. You know, we'll just go around and trapping idiots and provoking actually dangerous people. And, boy, you never seen such FBI budgets as we're going to have 2.5 years from now. You know?
Thank you to everyone for watching Keith Knight Don't Tread on Anyone in the Libertarian Institute. Scott Horton, author of Fool's Errand and Enough Already. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.